Welcome. Lovely to have you. So, now, I'm sure there are much more sort of synthetic and sort of broad ways to think about this question of sort of Rome versus Torah, like the conflict between Rome and Judaism, and I'm sure people have written many books about it. What I have here is more like a couple of Talmudic passages, a couple of sort of vignettes that really reflect on this question and try to understand what does Rome stand for, what does Torah stand for. So that's why that's what we're going to start with. We're going to start sort of just like delineating the sides, and then we're going to complicate it. Because, in fact, the relationship between Rome and Judaism is going to become more and more complicated and more difficult to disentangle as we go through the sources. And what does that say about both Rome and Judaism? And that's the kind of plan that we have going through here. Okay, great. So we're going to start with this story, which really kind of sets the boundaries for what constitutes like core Romanness and what constitutes core Torah, okay, at least according to the Talmud. And this is an interaction between Rabbi Akiva and Quintus Tineus Rufus, who is the Roman general involved in the Bar Kokhba revolt. So if you put all the stories in the Bavli, it doesn't say this specifically here, but if you put this story in conversation with other stories in the Bavli, it seems like this is happening on the way to Rabbi Akiva's execution. But like I said, it doesn't actually say anything about his execution in this text. But that's what you get if you go a synthetic reading. So we're just going to read through this, and some of it will make immediate sense, and some of it will seem a bit harder to relate to. But I think what Rabbi Akiva points to here, and what Tineus Rufus points to in the conversation, is a real difference in the way that Judaism thinks about the world and the way Rome thinks about the world. And we're really going to sort of choose sides. I have to choose sides in this conversation. Okay. Someone to read us in Hebrew or English, and I will take the license to stop you at any time. Just warning you.
This is the question that Quintus Tineus Rufus, the wicked one, asked Rabbi Akiva. If your God loves the poor, why does he not provide for them?
Okay, so that's the opening question. Okay, now we're going to find out that they're not really talking about the poor. Okay, they're really talking about Jews. But it starts off by saying, so, Rabbi Akiva, if your God loves the poor, why are there poor people? Why doesn't God look after them? Sure, clearly that proves God doesn't love the poor. Okay, keep going.
He said to him, in order that we be saved through them from the judgment of hell.
Okay, so this is not the answer I think you were all hoping Rabbi Akiva to give. Right, why? Yeah, I think I've got some right now. Which is, it's not about, I don't know what you were expecting him to give, but certainly this is not it. Right, which is that why are there poor people? So that others can be saved by helping them. Okay. Mm-hmm. By fulfilling the mitzvah of tzedakah. Okay, but we're going to see this becomes more complicated as it goes through. Okay, so continue.
He said to him, the opposite. This makes you liable for hell. He said to him.
Yeah, this is the Roman to Rabbi Akiva.
Responding, okay. Yeah. This makes you liable for hell. I will tell you what this is like. To what is the matter similar? To a mortal king that was angry with his slave and threw him in jail, commanding that no one should provide for him food or water. One person came and provided for him food and water. When the king heard, would he not be angry with him? And you are called slaves, as it is said, for the Israelites are my slaves.
So that's where you realize we're not talking about the poor, we're talking about the Jews. But let's just lay out the metaphor. So how does he explain, how does he look at the world, Tineus Rufus, and just come to the conclusion that God doesn't want you to help the poor? How does it work?
God made the poor poor.
Right. If God controls the world, God made the poor poor, put them in jail, quote unquote. And so if you go and try and rectify that situation, you're not doing God's will. You're doing the opposite of God's will. Okay? You're actually violating God's will. God set the world in the order that God wanted. And you're coming along and overturning it. Okay? And now put the Jews back in. So what is Tineus Rufus about saying about the relationship between Jews and Rome?
That God wanted this, because yeah. That's what God decreed, that the Jews should be persecuted by the Romans.
Right, God made you lose and us win. That's the law of the world. That's what happened, that's what God made happen. Right. By the way, it's important to know that none of the texts that we're going to do really think of Rome as Christian. Okay, we're all going to think of Rome as pagan. It's only sort of later texts that we really get to a full-blown Rome as a Christian empire. You don't need to worry about the Christianity per se. It might be behind the scenes in some places, but fundamentally we're thinking about Rome as the nation that destroyed the temple and the pagan nation that destroyed the temple, not the Christian one that it eventually becomes. But yes, exactly right. So if God let the temple be destroyed, The only reason must be that God wanted the Jews to be persecuted. And God put the Romans in charge. The Romans control half the world. Okay. So that's his basic premise, which is look at the world and you can see what God wants. And this is what it is. And to overturn it would be to go against God's will. Okay, let's continue to the next one.
Rabbi Akiva said to him, I will tell you what this is like. To what is the matter similar? To a mortal... Oh, so now he's responding.
Okay. Yep.
To what is the matter similar? To a mortal king that was angry with his son and threw him in jail, commanding that no one should provide for him food or water. One person came and provided for him food and water. When the king heard, would he not send him a gift? And we are called sons, as it is written. You are Adonai, your God's sons.
Okay, so what's the difference between Rabbi Akiva's metaphor and Tineus Rufus's metaphor? Slaves versus sons. And if you just change that one detail, now what does the king do when he finds out that somebody gave something to his son in jail?
Rewards him.
Right, because he's happy now, because it's his son. Even though he was angry with him to put him in jail in the first place, he still wants good things to happen to him. Okay, so now put that on the Jews. How does that work for the Jews?
People have power on earth to do good for the Jews, and that will make God happy.
Right. In other words, we are the sons, right? And that's what the claim. And also, by the way, I should have said before we get to that, put it on the way it works for tzedakah, on the way it works for giving money to poor people. How does that work? Right? Because we're talking about two things at once. We're talking about poor and we're talking about Jews. So how does this metaphor work for the poor? Just to be clear, make sure we spell it out. Right. And it's not we're undermining God's order. We're actually doing what God really wants, which is for his children to be happy, to be looked after, right? Even though, sure, God put them in jail. In other words, what we're not denying is that God controls who is poor, right? What we are denying is that God doesn't want you to rectify the situation. The opposite is true. God does want you to rectify the situation because fundamentally, God doesn't relate to that person as slave. God relates to that person as son, right? And similarly for the Jews in that way, right? If we ever... get out, if we, I don't know, it's unclear exactly how it works for the Jews, maybe. I don't know. If you help the Jews, whatever, God will be happy, I guess. So it's not a God-given order, per se. Or it sort of is a God-given order, but it's not designed to be this way forever. Yeah.
His anger is for a moment.
Right, exactly. Right. God's anger is for a moment, but fundamentally, God wants good things for us. Right. So this sort of lays the battle lines here, right? Rome stands for the status quo. Right? It's like the way it is the way it should be. If there's a reason why the way it is, that's because that's the way God wanted it. Right? In other words, whatever, if you have wealth, if you have power, you deserve it. That's the God-given order. Rabbi Akiva says, it's not so simple. Right? There's actually the people who are downtrodden that God doesn't want to be downtrodden forever, even though that is the order right now. I agree. That is the order that it is. But that's not the way it's always supposed to be. Okay, great. So that's clear. That's the battle lines, right? The Romans are the people on top deserve to be on top. The Jews are, the Torah is, that's not necessarily true, right? That's a temporary situation that can be undone. The way I think about this is I heard from the name of Stephen Geller, who's a professor at JTS. You can sort of summarize ancient mythologies and the way the Torah relates to them in the following way. That Egyptian mythology is that change doesn't exist. There's no such thing as change. That's basically their premise. When you die, you just continue living your life in the afterlife. Like, even death is no change. Egypt was eternal. Egypt always will be. That's the way they thought of it. Babylonian mythology, there is change, and it's always bad. Okay? There was an ancient day where the gods walked among us, and we had this amazing city, and every step since then that has changed has been worse. Okay? The whole point of the Torah is... change happens, and sometimes it's good, right? This is a very appropriate thing at this time of year. Sometimes the slaves go free, and the tyrants fall. That's the message. Sometimes. Not all the time. Maybe not even most of the time. But sometimes. Yeah? So that's the fundamental economy that I want to leave here, and really one of the most important messages of the Torah to the world is that you don't, like, the way the world is not the way the world is supposed to be, necessarily, and certainly not the way the world always will be. I think that's one of the most important messages of the Jewish tradition. It just comes straight through here in a conversation against Rome in general. And it becomes even more poignant if he's like literally on his way to death. right? It becomes a much more poignant conversation. But this is not the only thing that our rabbinic texts have to say about Rome and about Romans and about the difference between Rome and Judaism. We also have other things. So I've got this section here, Through a Mirror Darkly. You can thank me for the Star Trek reference. And so this is sort of a Rome as sort of a mirror image. It's sort of a built-in enemy of Israel that sort of goes back to primordial times. Okay, so I'm going to read us this text here from the Yerushalmi, text number 2. Please. Thank you.
He said, Rav Levi, the day that Shlomo married into the family of Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, Mikhail came down and wedged a reed in the sea, and alluvium rose up and it became a great thicket. This is the great city in Rome.
I don't actually know what alluvium is. I don't think it's a flower. Okay. Garlic? Okay, great, thank you. So, but the point, right, so in other words, so what something wrong happens, right? What's the wrong thing that happened in Jerusalem?
Shlomo intermarried
to the daughter of Egypt. That's bad. You're not supposed to have alliances with Egypt. Okay, that's bad. And at the same time, exactly the same time, sort of a mythical thing going on, God sent Mikhail, right, to literally plant the thicket of Rome, the foundation of the city. Okay, keep going.
The day that Yerevan set up the golden calves, Remus and Romulus came and built the two huts in Rome.
Okay, so this is Yerevan who decided to set up calves in Dan and Beit El to sort of split the worshippers going from Jerusalem. They wanted to come instead up to the northern kingdom and the split between the southern kingdoms and northern kingdoms. So the day that they split, the day that their worship was set up outside the temple, that's the day that Romulus and Remus built Rome.
Kind of nuts.
And I bet you didn't know that Romulus and Remus were in the Talmud, but here they are. Okay, so you can see they do know things about Rome, right? They live under them. They do know things about it. But in this case, it's sort of a mirror image. Bad thing happens in Jerusalem or in Eretz Israel. A corresponding good thing happens to the Romans, right? And all that our enemy is being set up by our own sins. Okay, and continue.
The day that Eliyahu was removed from the world, they set up a king in Rome. But there was no king in Edom. A viceroy was king.
So I think I probably mistranslated this. I think the way they're understanding in the Midrash, it might be the Pshat is a viceroy's king, but I think they're understanding in the Midrash, Nitzav Melech, a king rose, a king stood. Meaning there was no king, then a king stood. Right? Edom is code for Rome. So again, you have this same picture. Right, Eliyahu was like the last bastion. He was able to stop the worship of Baal for a short time. As soon as he leaves, that's when the Romans turned into a kingdom. Right, because that's the earliest, the Romans have kingdom, then republic, then empire. Right, so this is the earliest part of the kingdom.
How did Edom become code for Rome?
Yes, it's a good question.
And itself as well, right?
Yes, it's a good question. We'll come and play that out a little bit as we go, just a little bit. But yes, but it's a good question. We'll hold on to that. But that also fits in with the mirror image in the sense that, like, you know, Yaakov and Esav are obviously twins. Right? They're mirror images of each other. Okay, so how does this sort of portray Rome in relation to us?
A curse. That was a curse that we brought upon ourselves.
Right, that we're responsible for. Right?
Consequences.
It's consequences of our actions.
This happened.
Yeah, we messed up. Every time a Jew messed up, it made Rome stronger. Yeah.
But we're also the protagonist, and Rome is an antagonist that wouldn't exist if not for us. So it makes us the star of the movie.
Totally. But it is creating a movie villain, right? The movie villain is sort of the mirror image of the hero, and the actions of the hero at first make the villain stronger, right? Or even create the villain. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's actually an extremely apt metaphor. You can teach this class next time. So this is just a very different take on what's going on. Meaning we have the situation where we have fundamentally different worldviews. Status quo versus anything can happen. And here it's like, yeah, and the reason we ended up suffering under the boots of the Romans was because of us. Right? They're sort of the rod that comes to punish us for ourselves. Okay. Now we're getting into some Esav connections. So the fundamental, the main body of what we're going to do is we're going to be learning this story about in the Talmud about Rabbi and Antoninus. I wrote my dissertation on Rabbi, so that's why I naturally gravitated towards this source. But in a number of sources, he has a friendship. We'll see how nice it is, but friendship, let's call it for now, between him and a Roman emperor, Antoninus. A lot of things I could say about that. Number one, there are a considerable number of emperors between the 2nd and 3rd century, all called Antoninus, including the dynasty of the Antonines and also the dynasty of the Severans. Many of them were called Antoninus. I wouldn't say all of them. So we don't know exactly which emperor we're talking about if you're actually trying to match up to Roman history. But also, that doesn't matter, right? He's being used as a cipher for Rome more than he's being used to refer to any specific emperor. And Rabbi here, as like sort of the leader of the rabbis, is being used as a cipher for Jews in relation to Rome. Okay, so they're just being used to represent their people. They're not really being used as real characters here. So there's two things here. Firstly, you can see the sort of Esav and Yaakov connection in this Bereishit Rabbah piece, which is anchored on this text when they are sort of reuniting. Right? Yaakov is coming back from Lavan's house, and he gets to Eretz Yisrael, and he meets Esav along the way, and he sends gifts to Esav to sort of mollify the whole situation. And he says to the messengers, he says, "So shall you say to my lord, to Esav, Ladoni le'Esav." So we're picking up on this language of my lord. Rabbeinu, so let's assume that's the same as Rabbi, but I could say a lot more about that also. Rabbeinu said to Rabbi Ephes, said to somebody called Rabbi Ephes.
Sorry, who was Rabbeinu?
Let's assume it's the same as Rabbi for now. I'm not going to get too much into this. You could read 400 pages that I wrote. So write a letter in my name to our lord, King Antoninus. That's what he said to Rabbi Ephes, his assistant, I guess. He got up and wrote, "From Yehuda Nasir to our lord, King Antoninus." Okay, so it's a personal name with a little bit of a title, but basically, from me to you. Right. Rabbi took it, read it, and ripped it. He said to him, "Write the following thing." Don't write that thing, that was bad. Write this. "From your servant Yehuda to our king, to our lord, King Antoninus." So what did he change in the letter?
Your servant.
The title of Yehuda.
He took Nasir out. Right, exactly. So he emphasized the vast rank differential, which, by the way, is pretty appropriate if you're like a random guy writing to the emperor of the Roman Empire. That's like a pretty reasonable thing to do. But fine. It's to like emphasize the distance between the two of you. To which Rabbi Effa says, "My teacher, why do you disgrace your honor? Why did you lower yourself this much? He's only the Roman emperor." I don't know. And he said to him, "What, am I better than my ancestor? Did it not say, 'So said your servant Yaakov'?" Okay, so he's learning from Yaakov how to respond to somebody who is Esav, right? This is the connection of Roman Esav, and who is like basically somebody I assume is out to kill me, right? That's the Esav connection. And in that circumstance, it is extremely appropriate to lower myself, even though I'm greater in Torah or whatever, to write to King Antoninus and say, "Yeah, your servant, Judah, tells you something." Okay? So this sort of just lays up sets up the connection of Rabbi as Yaakov, Antoninus as Esav, and this, I don't know, sensible change in the way they communicated here. Which then is, this connection is going to be played out in the following sugya. Okay, so it's a sugya built up of a whole bunch of different pieces, we might not get all of them, we may skip around a bit, but it's all here. The other thing I want to say is that anything smart I say about the sugya, I learned from Alyssa Gray, who's a teacher at HUC, who wrote an excellent essay about this story. Which I'm going to be drawing on extensively and may not tell you every time that I'm drawing from it. Okay, someone want to start reading, and again, I'm going to be rude and interrupt you at any time. Please.
Antoninus said to Rabbi, "I want Severus, my son, to reign in my place and to make Tiberias a colony. But if I say to them one, they'll do it. Both, they won't do it."
Okay, so this is sort of the introduction to the story. Straight away, what do you notice about their relationship?
Close.
Very close. Okay.
Rabbi's like an advisor, it seems
right.
Like.
Right, he's an advisor. Right. Yeah. Right. I've got this problem. I don't know how to run my kingdom. Rabbi, can you help?
Yeah.
Okay, right? He's going to his rabbinic authority. Okay? Right, and the things he wants to do is he wants to set up Severus to reign in his stead, and he wants to make Tiberias, the city, into a colony, which comes with all sorts of tax benefits if you're a colony. It seems, I don't know, it seems like the only plausible reading he would be making Tiberias a colony is a favor to Rabi, because why does a Roman emperor care about this random town? Right, it seems like in the context, it's just a favor.
How would Rabi benefit? Rabi would, how would, doesn't the taxes and stuff that go to the emperor? Why would Rabi benefit from that? I'm sorry.
Because the Jews of Tiberias would benefit because they don't have to pay the same taxes that non-colonies. Yeah, exactly. They have lower taxes.
It becomes an opportunity zone.
Right, exactly. So, and who is he talking about? But if I say to them, who is he talking about, Antoninus? Right, the Senate. Seems like, or like whatever, the consuls. There's a whole complicated system of governance in Rome. The emperor doesn't have full control to do whatever he wants necessarily, or maybe he doesn't have the full informal power to like impose his will on this. So whatever, his assessment of the situation is that he can make sure one of these two things will happen, but he cannot make sure that both of them will happen. Okay, so Max, continue. Okay.
He brought a man and...
So this is Rabi, brought a man.
Yes. He brought a man and put him on another's shoulders and gave the upper one a dove and said to the lower one, say to the upper one to let the dove fly from his hand. He said, learn from this, that this is what he is saying to me. You ask of them that Severus, my son, will reign in my place, and say to Severus to make Tiberias a colony.
Okay, so how does the metaphor work here? So Rabi doesn't answer the question, he does, but only symbolically. How does the symbolic answer the question?
If you raise Severus and then give him the responsibility to make Tiberias.
Right, so the guy on top is Severus, the dove is Tiberius, right? Okay. So two-step process. Okay, you can't get both now, but what you can do is set up your successor and tell him to do. Maybe he'll have the capital to pull this off. Okay, so how does this relationship look? Like, what's going on here? What do you picture here?
It's a confidant.
Confidant, right. Say more about that.
It's giving him advice that if it was made known to everyone, it would work.
He's good. The strategic mastermind of the future of the Roman Empire.
Yes, right, exactly. And he gave it in code.
Right.
Right, it's all given in code. Right, because, presumably because if the Senate knew this was his plan,
right,
they would just say no to one or both of the things.
Mm.
And he, Rebbe, might be at risk if it was clear.
Great, right, the person who gave the advice. Right. On the other hand, it's a relatively transparent metaphor. But yes, right, it provides some plausible deniability. What do you mean? I didn't say anything to Antoninus. I don't know what you're talking about. But yes, right, so there's a confidant relationship. There's like he's supporting the Roman state, which is also going to become important later. And think about the way Antoninus is also portrayed here. Right, learn from this. This is what he's saying to me in the Hebrew Aramaic. Shma mina hachi kamarli. What does that sound like? That sounds like normal Gemara speak. Right, Antoninus is just like a normal student of Gemara. He's like a good Jew,
yeah.
Right? Who's like learning Torah from his Rebbe.
Yeah.
Okay. So that also, you can see the identities of Rome and Jew are not so stable as they used to be. Right?
Is making Tiberias a colony a good thing or a bad thing?
Good thing because of tax breaks.
Okay.
That's the main thing.
Good thing for Tiberias, maybe not a good thing for Central Rome.
Right,
because Central Rome gets less money.
Advising against his interests or with his interests.
Yes, well, Antoninus came up with the idea to make Tiberias a colony, so it's not clear exactly why he would do that. I think in the context you're supposed to understand it, it's like, oh, I love the Jews, I want to help you out,
yeah.
I'll make your Tiberias a colony.
Right.
But it's unclear exactly, yeah. And by the way, whether Tiberias was actually a colony at any time in the Roman Empire is not clear.
Irrelevant.
There's no actual evidence, but irrelevant to the story. Exactly. Okay, so let's keep going, guys. We'll do the next thing. Max, you're reading, right?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. you can also pass it on. I don't mind. I don't mind. It's fine. Yeah.
He said to him, "The important men of Rome are troubling me."
Okay, so there's another piece of advice, right? Antoninus talking
to Rebbe. He brought him to the garden. Every day he would uproot one radish from the vegetable patch before him. He said, Antoninus said, "Learn from this, that this is what he is saying to me. You kill them one by one, and they will not all overpower you."
Okay, so how does the radish, make sure we understand the radishing, the picking radishes, how does this work?
You want to overpower the garlic.
You want to overpower the garlic, the alluvium? Yes, exactly.
It's also like you pull up all of them at once, then
A, they're going to, like, you're going to use them all at once, you're going to, like, have access to them, and B, like, you might use them later on. So it's almost like being strategic. Is it all the important men, or can you kind of, like,
right,
pick out the one that's hurting you the most and move ahead from there?
Right, exactly. So one radish per day. You only need to kill one man per day, and eventually you'll get rid of all your enemies.
Pragmatic.
Yeah, very pragmatic. Okay.
Can you clarify the pronouns here?
Yeah. I translated it deliberately, ambiguously, and now I'm suffering the consequences. So he said to him, Antoninus said to hit to Rebbe, and then Rebbe brought Antoninus into the garden. And every day, Rebbe would uproot one radish from the vegetable patch before him, Antoninus. Then Antoninus is like, oh, I worked out what it means. It means I'm supposed to kill them one by one. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, right. Okay. Anyone else interested in the fact that a great rabbinic figure is recommending murder as a solution to a political problem? Okay, anyway.
Yeah.
Carry on.
But let him say it explicitly.
So now this is the sugya coming in. It's like, why didn't you just say it? Okay.
He said, the important men of Rome will hear me and trouble me. But let him say it in a whisper, because it is written, for a bird of the heavens will bring the voice.
Okay, so we just have a couple of back and forth. So first of all, like, why do you say explicitly? Oh, someone might hear. This is the voice of the sugya. The voice of the editor.
Oh, the voice of the sugya.
Yeah. And then they give a plausible thinking, what he was thinking about. It's like, well, I don't want the important men of Rome to hear me. So then let him say it in a whisper. Why not? Basically, walls have ears. Right? It quotes a pasuk that basically means walls have ears. Okay? So even in a whisper, you can't guarantee that it's going to go back. So this is already the sugya interposing and being like, wait a second, why are we doing this? But what they don't raise is, well, how is he recommending the death of people? Which is actually something the Tosafot brings up on this this part of the sugya, but we're not going to do that. Okay, so next, let's do the next slide.
He had a daughter called Gira.
So Antoninus had a daughter called Gira.
She did something forbidden. He sent him arugula, he sent him coriander, he sent him leeks, he sent him lettuce.
Okay, so this is another...
Love the
Jews. Yes, right. Another very cryptic line. Basically, all of these are puns. And it's the pun to, like, tell you what you're supposed to do, what Antoninus is supposed to do with the daughter. And Rashi goes through all the puns, and let's see if I can remember them. So first you have Gargira, which is arugula, and the name of the daughter is Gira. So obviously that's connected. And then you get Kusbarta, that's the coriander, and Barta is daughter. Right? So Kusbarta, I believe, is like, I think it's, I don't remember. Whatever. Shadarle Karate, that's, Karti is lettuce. Leeks. So that's leeks. And then Chasa is lettuce. So Chasa is definitely have mercy, like Chas. So in the end, it's going to be some merciful thing. But the exact meaning of all these puns is not totally clear. But the point is, he's sending him a coded message of what he should do with the fact that his daughter is causing him shame. So once again, we have the same picture. Not only Antoninus comes with matters of state, it also comes with personal questions, which are related to matters of state, but also different.
Sending the Roman a message in Aramaic?
Correct. A message which relies on the puns in Aramaic. Exactly right. Correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That is not going to be the most unlikely thing in this story. I'll put it that way. But then we have to ask, like, if given it's so historically implausible, what is the point of the story? That's one of the questions.
So it's historically implausible.
It's definitely, yeah. I mean, you'll see. As I said, this is not the most historically implausible part of the story.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
Would Yehuda have an? Would the Rebbe have an interest in real life for an empire rather than the republic? Is there something in the Jewish community at that time? Or
that's a good question. I don't know. I think, you know, the great advantage and the great disadvantage of having a more centralized leadership is if you are friends with that centralized leader, that's good for you. But then on the off chance that you're not friends with that centralized leader, that's much worse for you. So it could be something in there, I'm not sure. But yeah, it's a good question. But I think in general, it's very clear to me. I was recently editing a book of essays for Rav Yitz Greenberg, who's a senior scholar in residence at Hadar. And he's publishing a book of his sort of historical essays, goes back to the 60s. And one of the things that he argues very persuasively and very obviously is, like, liberal democracy is the best system of government the Jews have ever had. Like, it's the best for the Jews that has ever existed. And he has a lot of very good evidence for that. Anyway. Okay. Then we're going to go next. Yeah, please.
Okay.
You can also hand over whenever you're ready, okay. But feel free.
Every day he would send him gold crushed in sacks.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for correcting my mistakes.
Gold crushed in sacks with wheat on top of them. He said to them...
To the messengers.
Mm-hmm. Bring grain to Rabbi. He said to him, I do not need it. I have lots. He said to him, leave it for one after you, who will give to the one after me that comes after you. And those that come out, that come from them will be discharged through it.
So this is also the same thing about like, okay, we're friends, and that's good for the Jews, but what about the next emperor? Are we going to be friends? So Antoninus is helping Rabbi with an insurance policy. Here, I'm going to give you a bunch of money now, so you can use it to bribe my successors.
Wow.
Right? So you can keep being friends with the Roman powers. Right? That's how committed he is to this friendship. He's like, I understand this friendship may not survive my death, so I'm going to make sure, I'm going to give you the insurance you need. And he does it secretly, right? Because how does he send the gold? Right, with wheat on top. It looks like I'm just, and he says to the messengers, I'm sending grain to Rabbi. Here, bring this grain. But actually, it's all gold. Which also makes me wonder, I don't know, did they not notice that it's like a sack of gold under the grain? But fine, whatever. Maybe it's just enough of plausible deniability, but yes.
What is will be discharged with me?
I don't know. Nipok alaihu. It's not totally clear. But I think the point is basically that you'll be able to use this money to bribe the futures.
This is just a Swiss account. What does that mean? Antoninus is hiding his own money because he
wouldn't use it interesting.
Properly and it's
well,
to the next generation.
Could be. I guess the main point is that either way, the money is going to go to his successors.
Right. Either yeah, way, it's right. A trusted relationship.
Right. Yeah, that could be. Yeah, that makes sense. Meaning that I'm giving this to you because I know you need to use this for future emperors. So it's really my money and I'm really going to get it back. Right, yeah, no, good point. Okay, we're going to come back to this line before because in some ways it's sort of the center of the argument here. But we're going to come back to this. Okay, so now we're going to get to the most historically implausible part of the story. Okay.
He used to have a tunnel that went up from his house to Rabbi's house.
Okay, so this is definitely the most implausible part of the story, right? To build a tunnel that goes from Rome to Eretz Israel. Now, okay, fine.
His house in Rome?
Well, I mean, it doesn't say. So you could say, okay, yeah, fine. He has a residence in Tiberias.
Yeah.
And he has a tunnel that goes from Tiberias. Yeah, that could be true. Yeah, but nonetheless, if it's... It's still a bit implausible. Yeah, you're reading ahead? Yeah, it gets worse.
We're next door neighbors, the idea of like the Roman emperor having a tunnel.
Right, to his Rebbe's house. Right. Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, wait. Didn't we learn in that class, David, didn't we have, they talked about the president of Argentina who has like a rabbi, a Chabad rabbi?
Oh, maybe. I don't remember.
Yeah, so there is. I think that is a thing. Maybe it was Argentina, right? It was Daniel?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there is a thing. Like the president of Argentina has like a Rebbe. That he goes to sometimes. Anyway, so it does, it must happen. Sorry?
Nobody wants to be.
He's interested in Chabad.
Yeah, Chabad. It's a Chabad guy, right? Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Okay, nonetheless, so he has a tunnel. Let's keep going.
And every day he would bring two slaves. One he would kill at the entrance to Rabbi's house, and one he would kill at the entrance to his house.
So why did he kill the slaves?
Secrecy.
Secrecy, right?
Oh, okay. Wow.
Keep going.
He would say to him, when I come to you, let no man be found before you.
Okay, so they have to be alone. This is an extremely secret situation, so secret that Antoninus is willing to kill two slaves a day, right, to make sure that no one ever finds out about this, to build a tunnel.
Just to not bring slaves?
You're the Roman emperor. You're going to leave without slaves? Right, but this is part of the point of this, the like just over-the-top cruelty. I think that's actually part of the criticism of Antoninus here. I mean, like...
But also the allowance from Rebbe about the... He's fully aware... I mean, going back to this, like, he's fully complicit.
Well, let's see. Let's see how complicit he is. Okay? Because it gets worse. Okay, carry on.
Oh, good.
One day he found Rabbi Hanina Bar Chama, who was sitting.
Right, sitting before Rabbi. So,
He said, didn't I say to you, when I come to you, let no man be found before you?
So that's Antoninus getting upset. Why, I told you no one to be here. What's your student doing here? Okay, but then...
He said to him, he is no man.
All right, so that's Rebbe's response. How does that work as a response? What does he mean, he's no man? Yeah. Right, so it could be one way of thinking, like, he's just my student. He's not even a man. Another way of thinking about it could be, right, he's better than a man. This is no man. He's like an angel, right? So keep going.
He said to him, let him say to that slave outside,
Yep, outside the entrance.
say to the slave outside the entrance that he should get up and come here.
Okay, so what's Antoninus thinking right now? What's he saying to Rabbi Chanina bar Chama? What's he thinking? What's he hoping to happen?
I just killed a guy because if he's allowed in, he can go tell the slave that he can just hop up and it's all good.
Right, meaning that Antoninus knows the slave is dead. Rabbi Chanina does not know the slave is dead, it seems like. So what's the trick? What's the trick here? What's he trying to do? Okay, let's read a little more. Maybe we'll see.
All right. Rabbi Chanina bar Chama went out.
On page 5.
He said, what should I do if I go and tell him he was killed? One should not return with bad news. If I leave him and go, I will be dishonoring the kingdom. He prayed and gave him life and sent him in. He said, I know that the least of you raise the dead, but when I come, let no man be found before you.
Okay, so let's unpack what happened here. So Rabbi Chanina goes outside and he finds the slave is dead. And he's like, what am I going to do? How can I go back to the emperor and say, oh, by the way, your slave is dead? What's the emperor going to think? Right, but he killed him, right? So that I can't go back with the bad news. And what if I just run away? What's the emperor going to think then? That I killed him. I'm doomed. What am I supposed to do? So luckily for him, he prayed, and the slave comes back to life. Okay, so someone's looking out for him. And then he's like, as a tour de force, sends the slave into Antoninus, right? So now you can think about what Antoninus is thinking at that point when he sees the guy he literally just killed walk in the house, okay? As good as day, his response, sure, I understand the least of you can raise the dead. I told you not to have anyone here. Like, next time, make sure there's no one here. Like, fine, I'm glad it all worked out, good for you, but like, come on. Okay, so I think what was Antoninus thinking in the beginning? I think he's trying to test Rabbi Chanina, right? And, or at least, either way, right? Basically, he's either going to say, well, that got rid of him, because he's going to run away for his life now. Or he's like, well, let's see what happens.
He's testing him by killing the slaves.
Not by killing the slaves. The slaves he's killing anyway for secrecy. But why he sent Rabbi Chanina out to check on the slave seems to be testing him. Yeah. Testing out this guy who is no man. That might be the most historically implausible part, but maybe the tunnel is the most historically implausible part. Okay, let's continue here, and we'll do more of their, so Antoninus and Rebbe's conversation.
Every day he would serve Rabbi. He would feed him and give him drink. When Rabbi wanted to go into his bed, he would bend over before the bed. He would say to him, go up on me to your bed. He said to him, it is not appropriate to dishonor the kingdom so much. He said to him, would that they make me into a mattress under you in the next world.
Okay, so now what are you thinking about this relationship right now? And Antoninus, how are they? What are you thinking about this?
Too close.
Too close. Now it's getting creepy. Yes, right.
Who's speaking in this?
Antoninus. Well, Antoninus says, come up on me to go to your bed. And then Rabbi says, no, that's too much to dishonor the kingdom. Right, which is an interesting flip of what Rabbi Efes said to him in the other source.
So Antoninus is saying, step on me on the way to your...
Correct.
Oh my God.
The Roman Empire.
Yes, the Roman Empire is literally becoming the step for Rabbi to get into his bed. Right, that's what he wants to do. And he says, I wish I was your mattress in the next world. Like, that would be the best outcome for me. Okay? Which is funny and also creepy. And now just inject the power dynamics for a second. Terrifying. Like, now put yourself in Rebbe's shoes.
Yeah.
What are you supposed to do? Yeah. Right? It actually becomes terrifying here. Like, he can't get rid of this guy. Right? So far, by the way, right, so Antoninus serves him, but there's no indication that Rebbe likes him.
Right.
This seems very one-sided.
Yeah.
Okay?
Rebbe's just doing what he has to do because right. To power.
He's doing what he has to do because I'm dealing with an extremely dangerous man who's willing to kill 2 servants a day just to come see me.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Okay, carry on.
He, Antoninus, said to him, will I come to the next world? He said to him, yes.
Okay, so this is one of the great tropes of the Antoninus material in general. Like in other rabbinic texts, he often asks, will I be in the next world? And the answer is always yes. And in those other texts, it's basically praise. In this text, because we just had what we had before, you have valence of like, what else is he going to say? Mm-hmm. What is he going to say to the Roman emperor? No? Right? Okay.
He said to him, but isn't it written, there will be no survivor of the house of Aesop?
Okay, so that's, so now again, this is Antoninus acting like a normal student, saying there will be no survivors, so there will be no one in the next world. So how am I going to be in the next world? And the response is?
About one who does the deed of Aesop.
Yeah, that means someone who is as bad as Aesop. The implication, though he doesn't say it.
You, Antoninus, are great.
Sorry?
You, Antoninus, you're
right.
Great.
Yeah, you're great, right. But that's implication. He never says, you're great. He just says, just so you understand, Romans can go to heaven as long as they're not as bad as Aesop.
What was Aesop so bad? What did he do that was so bad in their eyes?
Well, exactly. So I think once Aesop becomes Rome, then they sort of feed off each other. The more bad that Rome does, the more bad the Chazal are willing to read Aesop. Right? Because if you open up Reishi Rabbah, you'll find them vilify Aesop as like somebody who was like born to worship idols. Stuff like that. Yeah. But yeah. From the Torah, you don't necessarily get that perspective. Right.
He was a nice guy.
You
forget yeah. his brother.
Yeah, a bit of a buffoon, but yeah. whatever, okay. And then, but it starts in Ovadia. So this text is from, this quote right here is from Ovadia, from Sefer Ovadia. That's where it begins. It actually says, the Esav saneti. Like God says that. I hated Esav. That's the most negative portrayal of Esav you get in the Torah.
What about what?
It's not totally clear, I think. Yeah.
When Aesop marries the Hittite woman, there's a reaction from his parents
yeah.
about how something to the effect of how bitter their souls became.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's one of the worst things that he does in that story, but right. whatever. Yeah. But overall, I think Aesop could be read sympathetically from the Torah itself. But like once you see Ovadia and you see like them God really call out Aesop, and then it sort of gets filtered through the Rome connection, then he's a villain.
But what's interesting is that in Christian literature, Esau becomes Israel and Jacob. Mm.
Yes, right, because we're fighting over who is actually Israel. Right, exactly. So the person who wrote the book about this is, I think, Carol Bachos, B-A-K-H-O-S. She wrote a book about, I think she wrote a book about portrayal of Ishmael in Midrash, and I think she also wrote a book about the portrayal of Esau in Midrash.
Because he was the firstborn, and they didn't like that.
Right. Well, also, yes, right. By the way, that's one of the things the Torah talks about being against the status quo, because the firstborn never wins, right? It's always like the underdog who comes up, because you don't know how the status quo is going to go. Okay.
It is also recited thus, there will be no survivor of the house of Aesop. Could it be for everyone? That's why the verse says, to the house of Aesop, about one who does the deed of Aesop.
Okay, so again, there's your sort of quoting a writer that sort of explains what was going on in that exchange. Carry on.
He said to him, but isn't it written, there is Edom, her kings and all of her princes? He said to him, her kings, but not all of her kings. All her princes, but not all her officers.
So again, Antoninus is not willing to buy it. You told me I'm going to the next world. This verse in Ovadia says I'm not. Rebbe deflects it, and he says, no. There's another verse that proves that I can't go into the next world. Because it says, there in the next world is Edom, her kings and all her princes. Now it says all her princes, but it doesn't say all her kings. Right? So I may not be going to the next world. Okay?
It is also recited thus, her kings, but not all her kings.
Oh, no, sorry. That's the response of Rebbe. I'm sorry. So Antoninus says, it says her kings and all her princes. Oh, it's right. And that's what I'm saying. Sorry, let me say this again. Yechezkel's talking about hell. That's an important context. Yechezkel is talking about hell. And he is saying, in Sheol, in hell, there are all of the Edom. And so Antoninus is saying, look, the text says that all of the kings of Esav go to hell. To which Rebbe says, no, it says her kings. It doesn't say all her kings. Okay? That's the main point. I'm sorry, I said that wrong the first time.
All her princes, but not all her officers. Her kings, but not all her kings, to exclude Antoninus Ben Severus. All her princes, but not all her officers, to exclude Katia Bar Shalom.
Okay, so then we're going to sort of veer into a different story. So that's mostly the end of Antoninus. Antoninus comes back a little bit. But the reason we have these other stories is because it also relates to the portrayal of the relationship between Jews and Romans. Okay, so we're going to get into those in a second. But the first thing I want to do is just pause for a second and just make sure we see the portrayal of Rebbe. And I'll point out one other thing that's going on here. So what do you think about this portrayal of Rebbe and Antoninus? What's going on here? What's your sense of the characters and who's being criticized? And why and for what? Right, because on the one hand, we talked about Rebbe seems like semi-complicit in Antoninus' atrocities. And on the other hand, we've talked about how Rebbe doesn't really have much choice. So, where's it going? Yeah.
My question is how coercive, like I feel like you're trying to lead us to say that this is coercive, that Antoninus is like, you know, standing there being like, tell me I'm good or I'll kill you. And Rebbe is like, yeah, of course. But it seems like if he can bring someone, a slave back from the dead, if he's choosing to send him advice, you know, I don't know how convinced I am that this is coercive. And
great.
He's not actually genuinely, you know, praising this guy.
Great, amazing. So there is a sense where you can read this, the Rebbe is like actively participating in this, and that could be because he actually thinks that he's a good guy.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, good.
Well, he thinks it's better for the Jews than he represents.
Right.
Great. That's right. Another way, he could be willing to suffer all of this because he thinks that's the best outcome for the Jews. Mm-hmm. I'm going to add one more ingredient here because you see where he says he sends the gold crushed in sacks in the middle of page 4. Notice what he says. Rebbe, when he sees the gold, he says, La tzarichna, I don't need that. Eat li tuva, I have a lot. Okay? If you go to page 8, I believe. Yeah, go to page 8. You see source 5, the Genesis text right here. Esav said, this is again the meeting of Esav and Yaakov, the reunion. Who is this whole camp for you that I met? Yaakov said, to gain your favor, my lord. Esav said, yesh li rav, I have lots. So Rebbe here is using the same line as Esav in the Torah. Right? So part of what this story is doing is saying, if you get too close to Esav, you become Esav. Right? Rebbe has actually become Esav. He's literally quoting him, just in Aramaic. So maybe it's what he has to do. Maybe it's what he thinks is the best for the Jews, but you should know it comes at a cost. Right? So this is the way, sure, can Roman Torah ever be friends? The answer is like, sort of, but you may lose yourself in that process. Right? That's one clear message that could be coming out of this story.
Would the Gemara criticize Rebbe?
Well, that's exactly the point, but it seems like that's what the whole text is doing.
Yeah, but would they do that?
Well, so maybe, because in part they are happy to say how terrible the Roman Empire is. And in general, the Roman Empire was much worse for the Jews than the Persian Empire, which is where they're living and telling the story. So I think one of the things they could be saying is, if you get too close to the Romans, you basically become the Romans. And therefore, they could be criticizing him.
And there are other stories that criticize.
Right. He also didn't have enough mercy.
In other ways, it's usually his amour propre or his, you know, arrogance or his not.
Right. Less high stakes. There's also a text where they criticize him for not having mercy on a calf that's going to be slaughtered. So yeah, definitely criticism happens. But yes. Okay. So that's sort of one strand here where we have like the relationship between Rome and Roman power and the Jews. Can be complicated, fraught, dangerous, but maybe the best option, okay? But now we're going to give other options of why, and this may help your question, Anna, other options of ways in which Jews and Romans can interact, but maybe more positive, okay? Because we just had Ketiah Bar Shalom, okay, who is apparently a Roman officer. That's what we've learned so far. Let's go. So Ketiah, what does Ketiah mean in Aramaic? Cut off. Okay, so that's going to become important later as we get a very gross detail in this story. Yeah, and his father's name is Shalom. That also helps, right? It's creating some peace here. Okay. So, okay. Max, you want to continue? You're doing a great job. I would hire you anytime.
What happened with Ketiah Bar Shalom? The Caesar hated the Jews. He said to the important men of the kingdom, one who has a thread on his foot, should he cut it and live or leave it and be in pain?
So who's the thread on the foot? The Jews. So he's saying, okay, they're being so annoying. I can't stand all these Jews. I'm just going to kill them. That's what I want to do. And just like you'd have to cut off something bad on your foot. Okay, and that's what they say.
They said to him, he should cut it and live.
Right, so then Ketiah Bar Shalom enters the scene. So they're about to launch pogrom.
Who's narrating here?
This is now the Sugya giving a new story.
The Sugya is giving a new story.
Yeah.
Ketiah Bar Shalom said to them, "One, you won't be able to defeat all of them, as it is written, 'For I spread you as the four winds of heaven.'" What is it saying? If you say, "I scattered them on the four winds," this "as the four winds" should have been "to the four winds." Rather, just as it is impossible for the world to be without wind, so too it is impossible for the world to be without Israel.
Okay, so just let's spell that logic for a second. The verse says, "For I spread you as the four winds of heaven." Their point is, if that meant directional, Katia's point is, if that meant directionality, that I will just spread you across the world, it should have said "to the four winds." The fact that it said "as the four winds," what that proves is Jews are eternal, right? Just as the wind is eternal, Jews are eternal. You will never be able to defeat them. Okay, that's his claim. Okay, one more thing.
"Further, they will call you a cut-off kingdom."
Okay, a cut-off kingdom meaning because you cut off the thread of your foot, you cut off a major part of your kingdom, which was the Jews. And of course, cut-off here is Ketiah.
Right,
so it's part of his name. Okay, continue.
"He said to him, 'You spoke well.'"
So this is now the Caesar speaking to Ketiah.
"You spoke well, but anyone who defeats the king, they throw him into a hollow furnace."
So great job, you defended the Jews, that was awesome, but also you defeated me, I'm the emperor, you have to die. Sorry. Okay? Emperors are not really coming across nicely in these stories. Okay, carry on.
"When they took him out, a noblewoman said to him, 'Woe to the ship that goes without the tax.' He fell on his foreskin and cut it off."
Okay, so this is the grosser part detail is in some versions, he like took it off with his mouth. Okay, and again, cut it off is the same, kata, right, the same thing. So another, what does it mean to say, woe to the ship that goes without the tax? What does that mean? What does she mean by that?
Can we back up? When they took him out, who's him?
Ketiah. To die.
Going to the furnace.
I get it.
You did your work, but you didn't get the reward for it?
Well, what's the tax?
His foreskin.
His foreskin. It's all very nice that you help the Jews, but the only way you're going to get into heaven is if you convert. Okay? So that's what he does. He just circumcises himself right there. Okay? In the grossest possible way.
"He said, 'I gave the tax. I will pass and travel.' When they threw him, he said, 'All my property to Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues.'"
Even better. He's going to give all his money to the rabbis. It's amazing. What a tzaddik. Right, exactly, right. Rabbi Akiva, who represented the Jews in his battle against Cneus Rufus, exactly. Right, right.
"Rabbi Akiva went out and explained it was for Aharon and his sons, half for Aharon and half for his sons."
So that means Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues. So Rabbi Akiva's like, "Oh, I'll get half," because they're written the same. But yeah, whatever, that's a side issue. Okay, continue.
"An oracle went out and said, 'Ketiah Bar Shalom is invited to the life of the next world.'"
So, okay, so this works. Right, this is a positive depiction of relationship with the Romans. Ketiah is a Roman who stands up to the Caesar to defend the Jews, is executed for that, and on the way converts himself to Judaism.
Wait, so Ketiah wasn't Jewish before?
Doesn't seem like it, though maybe he was. It's Bar Shalom, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he was. He wasn't circumcised, that's for sure. So even if he was Jewish, he wasn't circumcised, yes. Okay, and then we have a character we may recognize reacting to this.
"Rabbi cried and said, 'Some acquire their world in 1 hour, and some acquire their world in many years.'"
So what does that mean in this context?
All you do is one moment of tshuva,
yeah. Ketiah just did one thing, and then he's out. He's into heaven straight away. Other people work their whole lives. Okay, so that's one other model of how you can interact with Rome, which is you stand up to them, and you let yourself die, and you just become Jewish. Okay? A total rejection of Rabbi's model of accommodation and how do I suck up to you and work with you. A total rejection of that model. Like, no, you can't do that. You just can't deal with that.
You know that the emperor took Ketiah as advice?
That's what he says. He says, yeah.
He didn't cut him off, so I guess he did.
Right. He says, "You're right. You spoke well. But anyone who defeats the king, you still have to die." Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So then we get sort of an aside, and then we'll get the last story, which is about Aquilas, Onculus.
"Antoninus served Rabbi. Artaban served Rabbi."
So Artaban is the last Parthian king. So the Romans' main enemy in the east was the Parthians until about the 3rd century, around the time of Rav. And then the Parthians fell, and they were replaced by the Sasanians. So this is the last Parthian king.
"When Antoninus died, said Rabbi, the cord is separated. When Artaban died, said Rav, the cord is separated."
Okay, so now we have a sort of a parallel path in Persia and in in Eretz Israel, in the Persian Empire, in the Roman Empire, that there's some like chord between Rav and Artaban and Antoninus and Rabbi. Okay? Is this a good thing or a bad thing that the chord is separated?
Bad thing. Jews lost their...
Right. Jews lost their ally, their patron. Right.
But also it's a good thing because the guy who was putting him in these difficult situations is no longer there.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. He's also managed to get himself out of that impossible situation of a murderous ruler who thinks he's his friend. Right. Okay. But now we go to the last story, the last model of how you can deal with Rome versus Torah.
Ankelos bar Colonimus converted.
So this is it's not clear who it's a reference to. The famous Ankelos is the translator of the Torah into Greek and or Aramaic, depending on which tradition you're looking at. Ankelos, right, is just a Latin name, Aquilas, which is why I translate like that. Anyway, so it's not clear if that's the same guy as that or not.
Caesar sent a troop of Romans after him. He drew them in with verses. They converted.
So that's the first thing. First thing, the first group of Roman troops, they all become Jewish. Okay, so that's the way he interacts with the Roman forces. He just like teaches them Torah and makes them Jews. Okay, then the next thing.
He sent another troop of Romans after him. He said to them, do not say anything.
Okay, so this time, just like don't talk to him. Just don't do it. You can see what's about to happen.
When they came to take him, he said to them, I will say one word to you. The lower officer holds the torch before the next rank. That rank for the duke for the governor for the count. The count, does he carry the torch before anyone? They said to him, no. He said to them, the Holy Blessed One carried the torch before Israel, as it is written, and God walked before them by day in a pillar of cloud and by night in a pillar of fire. They all converted.
So another great Parsha connection, totally intentional. Right, so what's the difference between being a Roman and being a Jew?
God likes the way for us.
Right, God, the highest of the hierarchy, is the one who lights the way for us. When you're a Roman, you have to do all sorts of terrible, annoying things for your superiors, and they don't have to do anything. Right? But God lights the way for us. And they're like, oh, good argument, good point. Don't want to be Roman anymore. This seems a lot better. Okay.
Circles back to the first story, the difference between the tyrant and who helps the poor, who doesn't help the poor.
Right, exactly. Yes, to a certain extent, right? God like looks after all Jews and we don't have the same hierarchies the Romans do. Yeah, right, totally, exactly right. And similarly, it's like, you know, God is willing to overturn what you might have expected the status quo to be to look after us. Right, it does in that way go back to Tineus Rufus. Okay, yep.
He sent another troop after him. He said to him, do not converse with him.
So that's first it was don't even say a word to him. Now it's like, don't talk to him. Don't do anything. Okay? You can already see what's going to happen.
When they took him, there was a mezuzah placed at the entrance. He placed his hand on it and said to them, what is this? They said to him, you tell us.
Oh, they fell into the trap. That's it. They're gone.
He said to them, in the way of the world, a mortal king sits inside and his servants guard him from outside. But for the Holy Blessed One, God's servants are inside, and God guards them from outside. As it is said, God guards your going out and coming in from now until forever. They converted. He sent no more after them.
So once again, it's the egalitarian argument here, which is again, like you lowly Roman soldier, you have to guard your superiors. But you know who guards us? Hashem. Right? The greatest rank. Right there on the mezuzah, okay? Great, so this is a very different strategy of how to deal with this, and this seems to be the most successful way of dealing with the Romans, which in this way is, make them Jews, right? Like, make an argument on the merits. Actually, like, you could be better with us, right? This is not accommodation, this is not getting close to Roman power, it's a rejection of Roman power. But it's a more subtle rejection than Ketiah Bar Shalom, who gets executed. This guy gets to live. Right? Onkelos just outsmarts them. Okay?
I'm curious, because if we went like related back to like interacting with people that we were having to engage with on different planes of thought or whatever, it's at the very least he's coming to them and like just engaging with them of In Points of Curiosity, where with Katia, it was about proving a point.
Right.
With Rebbe, it was about being complicit and just kind of going on being like, please God, don't turn your anger on me, which is a very fair position to have. It's interesting to acknowledge that it's like, hey, this is who I am. Let's engage. Let's talk about that a little bit. He was, because I don't think he's really speaking to convert them. I think they convert because they like his point.
Right.
I don't think his goal is that, but his goal is like,
hi. He's just like, hey, let me tell you about the Torah. It's kind of amazing. And let me just tell you about it. I'm unapologetically who I am, right? That's the other way. Like, Rebbe is willing to sort of blur his own identity to become Esav in order to accommodate Roman power. And Onkelos is not willing to do that. He's like, no, you can come to me. I've got the great Torah. Come learn it with me, right? And he converted. That's the other interesting part of that identity. Like, he chose this identity. It was not given to him in the same way. And so did we see Bar Shalom, but only on his deathbed, and only sort of. Because, I mean, right, is it a halakha conversion to bite your foreskin off with your own mouth? Probably not. But yes, for sure.
It's almost dinner time.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're right. Okay, there's one more coda to this, one more coda in the sugya, and then one more coda that I want to point in Tosafot about sort of the complications that happen here. So one more coda in the sugya.
God said to Rivka, two nations are in your womb. Said Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav, do not read nations, but high ones.
This not is, goyim, but geyim.
This is Antoninus and Rabbi, such that lettuce, cucumbers, and radishes never ceased from their tables, neither in the summer nor in the winter.
So this again just pulls us back. This is, we're talking about Yaakov and Esav, but it just says two nations. It just says two high ones. It doesn't say which is which, right? So we end on this fairly ambiguous note. It's like, yes, these are the embodiments of Yaakov and Esav, but I don't actually know which is Yaakov and which is Esav anymore, right? As opposed to Katia, who takes his stand, and Onkelos, who keeps his identity. And this sort of gets ramped up to the next level in a legend that Tosafot tell on this story in medieval France, where they quote a Midrash, which is not, I don't know where the Midrash comes from, I don't know if it's extant in any other text, but this is the Midrash that they quote. Max, you're doing such an amazing job, you're doing great.
We say in a Midrash, milk renders impure, milk renders pure.
So the same milk might make some, well, the way milk renders impure is like an animal that suckles from a treifa, this is in the Mishnah in Chulin. If you have an animal that's dying, and another animal suckles from that milk is actually treif. So that's the halakhic point, but it's now being used metaphorically here, okay?
When Rabbi was born, they decreed not to circumcise, but his father and mother circumcised him. Caesar sent and brought Rabbi and his mother before him, but his mother exchanged him with Antoninus and nursed him until she brought him before Caesar. So he found him uncircumcised and dismissed them peacefully. Yet that leader said, I saw that they circumcised that one, but the Holy One, blessed be He, does miracles for them at every instant. So they rescinded the decree.
Okay, so it starts off by trying to prove that the Jews have violated the decree against circumcision, but then the babies got swapped, and so the child was not circumcised, and like, oh, I guess we're all good here, and moved on, decree was gone. So, but the point of this, Tosfot, is ranking that, putting that up to the next level. Rebbe and Antoninus, they're exactly the same.
Doesn't even say that they switched them back.
Right. And I'm not even sure they did. They're exactly the same. They're just the same. They're twins. They're the Jews and the Romans. There's no distinction. Yeah. Right? Milk renders pure, milk renders impure. Sometimes the same milk produces a good person or produces a bad person. And that's also like a very unsettling way to think about this. We started off with these very core two sides. And through Rebbe, we've realized that those sides are not as clearly delineated as we hoped, that you can end up compromising that. And through the Tosafot, we end up there are no sides. But you don't know. You could fall into Rome, and you could fall into the Torah, and either is viable. It's not a very hopeful message, a hopeful ending. But I think what it is a real reflection on, like, how does one get close to power and get close to like a powerful culture and maintain your own identity and maintain your own integrity. And that's like the reflection of this story of Rabi. And like, I don't know, we'd like to think that obviously we stand for the Torah. We know that the world could change at any moment. And they stand for the Rome. They think that the world as corrupted as it is the best it's ever going to be. And it's the way it's supposed to be. But we can so easily fall into the trap of thinking the way the status quo is the way it's supposed to be. And there's no fundamental distinction between those two attitudes. We could easily get confused about them. So I think that's the call here and the way to think about this and the way to sort of, you know, bring the Torah into as many ways, many places of life as one can, of like imagining, looking at the way it is, and be like, this is not necessarily the way God intended it to be. Let's work out a way that we can actually improve and make it different and make it better and imagine something else. And that's, I think, one of the major gifts of a Torah to the world and the way in which we really do stand in opposition to Rome, even though the lines are blurry and it's easy to fall from one to the other. Thank you very much for learning this with me and for letting me teach you some dissertation material. So indulging me, getting to talk about my favorite rabbinic character.